And my first question to you, Paul, is do you know how much cough syrup you can take before you can't drive a car anymore?
I don't know what would happen first, whether you would exit the cough syrup from your body or if you would be at the point where you can't drive. It's a bit, yeah. It feels like the thing of how many bananas can you eat before you get radiation poisoning.
Right. If we're talking about that sort of level,
honestly. It's that kind of a question to me.
Right. Yeah. No, the reason I'm asking is because I definitely, having taking a swig of it before the recording, I definitely felt a bit tipsy.
just you know, free form, drink swinging it from the bottle. It's the way to do it. It's the way to just neck medicine. That's what I do.
Look, listen.
Forget it. See what happens. What's the worst that's going to happen?
Look, listen, when you're in dire circumstances, when you're in a hotel in the middle of nowhere and you have a podcast recording and you have not been sleeping and your throat is not being cooperative.
Not judging, and I want everyone to know that I gave you an out on this episode as well. I said, it's fine, we don't have to, but no, we're doing it. So
you're getting cough syrup. You're getting cough syrup, Lydia. This is what you're getting.
Spoiler alert, but we could just write some notes and then Google's going to make a podcast for us anyway, because that's what they do now.
I wonder if at this point there's enough hours of my voice on the internet that somebody can just make a perfect replica of it and just make a podcast.
It's worryingly easy to do.
Don't tell me these things.
I know, I shouldn't. I shouldn't. And I wish I didn't know them, but I do. But there we are. I have to say, we've kept the little syringes that you get when you buy kids' medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago, you used to get little spoon.
Yeah, I remember the spoons, yeah.
Mm. You don't get those anymore.
No, you don't.
No, you get the syringe. And because you get like one syringe, obviously, with the bottle. But because, you know, being eco-friendly and stuff, and actually just they're quite useful to have, we now have a tub of syringes. Mm-hmm. And I look at it, and I looked at it the other day and went, that's just how much medication we've gone through in what is not that much time. But it just feels like we're just perpetually, you cycle through the seasons. You cycle through winter, so you have cold. And then you come into spring, so you have spring colds. And you have summer, and you have summer colds and hay fever, and then you're back in the autumn again. And it's just a cycle. It's just the cycle. With children, it's colds. With adults, it's depression. You have seasonal depression, you have regular depression. And that's the cycle that you go on, and that's life. Welcome to the Wandering Tech Podcast, where we talk about medication and how much you can drink before you can no longer drive.
Oh, and this is this is one of your co-hosts, Lydia, who has been necking cough syrup in attempt to be here and be able to do a recording. And I'm joined as always by the wonderful Paul Harris, who just shared with me the whole syringe thing. And the only thing I can imagine is, you know how when you're trying to give medicine to cats, you need to like hold them by the throat practically and like shove syringes into their mouth? That's how I for a moment pictured you dealing with your two children.
Surprisingly compliant. I think they just acclimatized to it now. We just put it in front of them like, okay,
right,
and take it.
No, holding at the back of the jaw to keep the mouths open. This is why, if anyone is wondering why I have zero desire to have kids, the fact that I thought you need to hold your kids' jaws open to put medicine in them is a mark towards that I should not be getting close to kids. Anyway, do you want to talk to me about Mark Zuckerberg instead of talking about kids?
I could talk about Mark Zuckerberg, couldn't I? I sent you a newsletter, and I recommend anyone who doesn't read Platformer by Casey Newton. He's one of the hosts on Hard Fork. He's been writing about tech for a number of years, and it's a very very good read, very interesting. And I frequently get a lot of my tech news. We used to get it from his Twitter account, now kind of from his Thick Blue Sky is where I follow him. I'm not really sure, I've lost track. Too many social media accounts. And also his new editor, just tech news. I think he's a very interesting person and he has a very interesting perspective on these things. But he was writing about an interview that Mark Zuckerberg did on the Acquired podcast, where he essentially said that Zuckerberg is done saying sorry or maybe not saying sorry, but he's done taking accountability for the things that people do on his platform. So Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. And I just feel like this is going into an area, and I'm sure many people will be familiar with what has kind of happened with Meta as a company since about 2016. Obviously, they've kind of had this, and they are still on this little weird, hey, we're going to be the metaverse company. But at the same time, they've been having this massive issue with content moderation. And what really struck me about this piece was kind of two things. First of all, this idea that, you know, he's like, look, we've tried to control what people put on our platforms. Whatever we do the quote unquote wrong thing. So we're almost just kind of going a little bit hands off now, and I'm going to kind of stop saying sorry. And this kind of, to me, is symptomatic of sort of, there's two different things. One of them Newton writes about, and the other one I'm kind of interested to get into as well. But the first one is, and I'm just going to quote directly from the news editor here. Newton says, I write all of this because in a world where tech companies are very rarely held accountable in meaningful ways, it matters what CEOs do and do not feel responsible for. It matters if they decide they no longer want to take ownership of societal level problems, even when their companies may be exacerbating them. And I'm just like, oh, okay, yeah. And then what that made me think about was this kind of new, I think it's new, we can discuss how new it is, which is the sort of the rock star CEO. So in the vein of people like Elon Musk and Jensen Huang of Nvidia, these people who, you know, people talk about Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was a nerd and he owned that. He was not a rock star by any means, right? He owned his aesthetic and his style. But these people that are trying to kind of be modern, yeah, like I say, like modern day like rock stars or significant characters, they're more invested in their public perception of who they are than necessarily actually owning what it is they're come to.
Yeah. And I think, like, when you say the rockstar mentality, like, I'm exactly picturing that, like, you know, the NVIDIA CEO coming up on stage and, like, a whole crowd of nerds just, like, shouting at him, which may have happened to Steve Jobs once or twice, but more often than not, and actually, funnily enough, there has been, like, a video circulating on LinkedIn recently of Steve Jobs, like, I think it is one of the earlier WWDCs where he's sitting on a chair and practically he's being heckled from the crowd and being asked very deeply technical questions about like where the product is going and everything like that. And to me, whilst yes, he did have a persona that people obviously were very, you know, opinionated in one way or the other, it seemed like there wasn't that sort of big fanfare as it is nowadays. And by the way, I don't think it's just tech CEOs. Funnily enough, I do think, and I might be wrong on this, so don't quote me on this, but it feels like it is more from like the gaming industry. So the gaming industry CEOs, like I remember watching like a BlizzCon, like a live stream of a BlizzCon, and every single person that like from a C level to an executive to like a game developer, not game developer, game designer would come up on stage, and people would just be losing their minds over these people on a stage. And to your point, like they're just nerds, and nerds are awesome, but like, that is a very weird personification of what we want tech to be. Like, we want these people to be, like, amazing. Mm. So that is a weird one. And I've seen as well, and it's just, it doesn't compute with the way I'm observing these people.
No, and I think that it makes me think that they're not serious. It makes me think they're not serious people, and we're dealing with serious things. And this is a very, and again, I appreciate this is kind of quite a deep topic to get into, but...
Yeah, but let me acknowledge, like, what you said there about like them being serious people, because I think you're right. Like, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, tech has moved on for just being for nerds or just being for people who are into this stuff or companies, and it's greatly affecting our day-to-day life. Mm. And I know you and I have spoken in like not on the podcast about like my whole, like what is starting to become a bit of an obsession about tech obfuscation and the dangers of it. And that sort of aligns a little bit with what are the realities and the risks of day-to-day life with having these tech giants, the companies themselves, influencing our day-to-day lives so much. Can you argue that they also influenced our lives a lot, like, you know, let's say like 20, 30 years ago? Maybe. Yeah, just not maybe. I think it's the direct impact. It's the day-to-day impact. It's the fact that you're grabbing whatever device that you have on hand. Mine, like the closest one I have is like my iPhone, being influenced greatly what the Apple were doing, being greatly influenced by the apps I have on in place. Like I have Instagram on my phone nowadays, which is maybe a mistake. So thus I'm being greatly influenced daily by these companies. Whilst maybe before it was more of a tectonical shift in society that these companies sort of had that power to do, but it's different nowadays. But what I was thinking is, as we were talking about them taking responsibility, and yes, serious people take responsibilities, unserious people don't take responsibility. I do think if you consider, like, I don't want to keep on like hammering onto that serious people point, but I do think they are serious people in the sense of like they know what they're doing. I do truly believe this is incredibly purposeful what they're doing, of trying to like let go and just announce that whatever they're doing, it's a public forum. They can't control everyone's feelings and how they do things and everything, which I agree to a point, because they are providing the service they're providing is a platform for people to do things on. Is it then their responsibility to moderate it? Maybe. But what I was thinking the entire time is, and this might be again just me not remembering how things were back in the day, but do you remember like when, like, we could talk about big internet, small internet quite a lot, and Reddit used to be like this a little bit as well, where it self-moderates to a huge degree, but there wasn't a incentive for the platform for people to click and point at different things. Do you see what I mean? Like,
I do, yes.
There wasn't an incentive for those platforms to get people riled up and clicking things and engaging in that platform, which is different from the algorithm-driven platforms nowadays, like Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, etc. But I think there lies that very small deviation between those two worlds, where, yes, were there horrible things being posted and said on forums, you know, back in the day before, like, the broader social media? Absolutely. There were forums made for awful things that were not moderated, purposefully almost. But you had the choice not to go there. You had the choice not to engage. Whilst when it's the content you're perceiving is not one you choose, but one that's being fed to you, that is a different thing. And this is where I don't think people like Mark Zuckerberg need to take responsibility of the content. I think they need to take responsibility of their algorithm and their business model. Because their business model is ads, right? So however many people click, however many people engage with whatever controversial content is out there, the more money they make, which leads to what? The fact that they're going to be incentivized to allow for that to happen, which makes sense for them to say, oh, sorry, not our problem, we'll just keep on cashing out on this, but we're not going to take actual responsibility. If you actually want to not take responsibility, let it be not led by algorithms. Let it be people subscribing and not feeding them anything on a For You page or a home page or whatever. Remove the ads. Done! You can get your hands off the keyboard and go like,
end capitalism, done. There you are. Happy. Mic drop. I mean, yep.
Stop capitalism.
This and this goes into so many other things, and I'm glad you actually brought up this idea of like the right, you're right, okay, and the era of the internet in which we grew up in. Like, it's a cliche to talk about the Wild West, but it really was a Wild West. It was unmoderated by an external party. And yeah, there was an aspect of like self-moderation to it, but also there was just so much that was freely available that you did not have to search for. Now, I think the other thing that interests me kind of here is content moderation has also then, it's like, okay, it's made the bad stuff go away. And that has meant that there's been a kind of an increase in stuff that maybe shouldn't be shared, being shared on social media because people think it's a quote-unquote safe space.
Do you really think the bad stuff has gone away? I don't think the bad stuff
I'm not saying it's gone away. No, but I'm saying that there's been this attempt to kind of suppress it. Or there was.
Right.
The goal of content moderation is to suppress the bad.
Right.
It's to say, we don't want this on our platform. Now, okay, bad may be the wrong word. Content...
harmful.
And I think it's harmful or not what you want on that platform. And I think about it, even as we're looking at, you know, with the newsletter that we've launched, subscribe, that we're looking at building a community around that. We now need to start thinking about content moderation, because the moment that you open up a space online for people to come in and interact, you then have to start thinking about, oh, hang on, I've got to start thinking about content moderation. Now, the reality is, you know, hopefully, as you say, mostly be self-moderating. I think like LinkedIn is a pretty self-moderating space, but then I do check my privilege on I'm not the profile of person who's going to be exposed to the less pleasant side of that. But I think in suppressing, so take a tangible example that we've talked about quite a lot, which is people sharing images of their kids on different social media platforms. And obviously we're kind of speaking in September now, like it's been back to school, so there's been this like explosion of people going, oh, it's first day of school, first day of this, first day of that. And it's something that I've never done, it's something I will never do. And there's a link to a video that we can drop in the show note that you shared with me that I think is super powerful about this. But I think
yes, please, and please everyone do watch it.
If
you have ever posted a picture of a child, any child, please just watch that video for my sake. Just watch, like, it will hopefully fundamentally change how you perceive things for the worse, unfortunately, but I feel like it's our duty,
right? But I think it comes back to the thing of going, Newton acknowledges this in the article. He talks about 2016 kind of being a turning point. I think the 2016 election and the Brexit vote was a turning point when people suddenly kind of woke up and went, oh, hang on, what's actually being shared on these platforms? And maybe we should think about that a bit more. And I struggle with that because my own, and I, without getting into kind of my own personal politics, I'm kind of a bit like, look, you choose to consume what you choose to consume, and you have your views. But I think, as you said, it's when that stuff is presented to you, and when I go and I'm sort of having this without that kind of really quite harmful pipeline, as you say, why does it exist? It exists because it makes money. Why does it make money? Because it gets views. Will it keep getting pushed? Yes, because it makes money, because it gets views, it sells ads.
Yep.
We can't solve that problem. But what I do think is super interesting is it also comes to and to maybe kind of bring this to some kind of conclusion, because if you're kind of sat there listening, thinking, hey, this isn't like really the normal cheerful stuff, and I'm sorry if it's not that cheerful, but it's an interesting topic. But I do want to kind of say, well, what can we do about it, right? For me, I think it comes back to a lot of this stuff, and I feel like this is probably going to become a recurring theme, which is take ownership of it, right? You can't, as an individual, change the content that is going out across all the social media platforms you use, but you can change what you put on. And it's this thing of, if you change it, then you, I guess, it doesn't feel like you're making a difference to the whole thing, and maybe you're not, but you're doing what you can. I think taking ownership and being, especially when we have, and we mentioned Musk already, I'm reticent to talk about him really any more than I absolutely have to, but I made the conscious decision to leave Twitter because I went, I just don't want to be contributing to this platform. And I think that's a decision that people have to own, and rather than being a victim and saying, oh well, it's awful now, it's like, okay, well, own it. We had a life before this, there will be a life after it. And I know you're saying you just got Instagram on your phone. I deleted Instagram about a month ago. I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything.
It is about what, choose carefully. It's the same thing as eating, I think. It's the same thing as consuming nourishment. What are you nourishing your brain with? And to be honest with you, at this point, I need some slapstick funny things that I found on the Balkan version of Instagram, which is what's been practically my algorithm-fed thing. But to your point, yes, this is the only thing I have in my power to do right now. That doesn't mean that I don't have, you know, and we shouldn't keep on having these conversations about who should take ownership and how things should be happening. Because, of course, you can always say, oh, but, you know, you have the power to change your own world, but your environment matters. So I still think that these conversations need to happen. There still needs to be a level of, yes, like, let's keep on highlighting the fact that, no, you cannot be responsible as a platform owner for all of the content, but you are incredibly responsible for the content that's being pushed out there more and more. If there is some level of algorithmic choice or homepage or for you page that people are tuning into by default, these are choices. This has not happened by accident. There was a design choice for these apps, for these platforms, for this to happen. And to the point, because of money. Money. It's always about money. I don't want to turn this podcast into Lydia rants about capitalism every other episode, but I think it's really important to be realistic about these sort of things, and knowledge is power in this case. Understanding why things work the way they do gives you more power to make the choices that are going to be better for you in the long run. My choice at the moment, as I said again, Balkan Instagram.
You might not have noticed, Lydia, because they've been quite about it, but Consensus have acquired Reach Suite.
Oh, what a surprise!
What a shock!
My LinkedIn has not been orange in no. Consensus corporate colors for like the last 3 weeks. No, not at all. No.
What do you think?
Kudos, right? I think they're very happy about that. I think they're very proud of that. I was not familiar with Reach Suite before the acquisition happened. So I don't think I'm in a place to sort of say like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense that they've done that, or oh, why did they do that? As a whole, simply because I'm not familiar enough with the product. I'm pretty sure come beginning of October time, when I go down to London, I will hear all about it and I'll get all the details that I need from DemoFest. Which, by the way, if you are going to London, give me a shout. I'm happy to meet you guys when I get there. So genuinely, I'm a little bit, I would say, like, undereducated on the matter. I know what Consensus were trying to do as a company, or where they were going, and that's based on their messaging, based on us talking to different people within Consensus, and based practically on what we, you and me, Paul, sort of perceived that the market of pre-sales tooling was going, and demo automation, and that sort of like that market, like the B2B selling demo automation space. I don't know where Reach Suite actually sits in all of that. I have an idea what their feature list is, and that's the only thing I can say. As I was looking through their feature list and what they could actually do, there was a head-scratching moment of, okay, how are you going to fit all that together? If that is the intention, to fit all those together, which we don't know if that's the intention.
No. And I think it's obviously worth kind of disclosure. It's part of it. We've both been speakers at DemoFests at various iterations of, and I think...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It was my gut reaction was, oh, that's interesting. When I saw it, again, like you, I was not familiar with Reach Suite prior to the acquisition. I was familiar with some other companies, I would say, in that, I'll call it like interactive sandbox demo space. Mm-hmm. Maybe, like, I think that's kind of, I was familiar with the concept of it, not familiar with Reach Suite as an organization. So that was kind of interesting. I think, like you, I've not seen the product, I've not tried it, so I can't pass comment on what it does. What I can sort of do, and what I wanted to try and do, was just have a bit of discussion with you really about more the proposition that I see Reach Suite as a product fitting into, and thinking about this idea of essentially productizing and to a degree automating POCs and POVs, which are, if you quote friend of the show Ramzi Majabar, he would say POCs are where deals go to die.
Yep.
You can get into that. That's another debate. And I agree that unscoped or poorly scoped POCs are where deals go to die. It's a whole other debate for another time.
Look, listen, there was a... I don't think so. I think this is a really important debate to have right now, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Because
I have a very strong opinion.
Yeah, I have a very strong opinion on this. I think POCs are universally, even with the best intentions in mind, they are a waste of time. My whole role at VMware as a field SC was POC avoidance. We did so many things to avoid specific products, mind you.
Yes. Okay?
So we had products that were POC-able left, right, and center. So I would just shove them into customer environments because they didn't change anything. They were just monitoring tools, right? So things that don't touch anything and don't change anything, absolutely, Bob's your uncle, have your fill, go for it. People can download it by themselves. They can install it by themselves. I can just go in, do like a little bit of demo with their own data. It was fantastic, right? Actual fundamental infrastructure, like serious infrastructure products, which fundamentally may change how an organization's data movement works, not great for POCs.
And this
because
is the thing.
There are so many variables, so many things can go wrong, especially if, again, which in my case was a security product. All it takes is one rule, one policy out of place for things to go completely off kilter, and for me to get into a lot of trouble. That meant that it was a huge investment from our side. It was a huge investment from customer side. Were POCs a thing at VMware for my specific subset of products? Of course they were. That, we couldn't avoid it in some situations. But by default, the answer to a POC was no. we're not doing POCs. We're going to do everything in our powers to avoid POCs. So here I then stand, you know, and you and I are, you know, actually, I don't think you and I have actually spoken about POCs all that much because I don't find them interesting. But there is, as you said, like there is a subset of products that do provide that. And to give you like a little bit of background, so what we did is actually providing experience days, and we called them that, which is practically customers came in, you know, there were a couple of field SEs, you know, having a chat with them. They were given practically what we're discussing here, which is a sandbox environment that they can play, mm-hmm. break everything. But it was, you know, from a VMware's perspective at the time, it was, you know, self-hosted, no additional tools, no nothing. We know there was a team dedicated to do that stuff. We would, the idea of bringing in a tool to do this for us was just out of the question. So I'm really struggling with this, and I'll be honest with you, I'm struggling with this subset of products because
mm-hmm.
POCs and sandboxing is really important for the infrastructure and I guess less human friendly UIs of products. When people actually need to understand and like play and break things to figure out how this thing works. I don't mm-hmm. see the use case for then SaaS-based products like Salesforce, where nothing fundamentally critical is running on top of Salesforce itself. Salesforce is the fundamentally critical thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is no... See, this is why I'm struggling. Like, why do we need this?
Yeah.
Is my question.
Yeah, I am inclined... So, first of all, we haven't ever talked about POC. And I now want us to do a whole dedicated section just kind of getting into it because I think it's super, cool. super interesting.
Spoilers for the next couple of episodes.
Particularly, as you say... from an infrastructure point of view. And I would say I look at that from my like pre-software career, which was involved in networking and hardware. And yeah, like I was the customer, right? And I was like, the idea of like, oh yeah, we're going to POC a switch, like that doesn't work. And I mean, the way that, so candidly, I remember when Meraki, the Cisco line, was first released, and then like the smart switches and smart access points. So again, if you're not familiar with networking, essentially, very cool kit with some nice software, a lovely UI that you could do fun stuff with that you could do with existing hardware, but it was much, much harder to do. But the Cisco line also came at a much bigger premium. But what, I as far as I ever got with it, right? And at the time I was working in a school and Cisco said, hey, have a free wireless access point and it's just going to work in your existing network. It will just work on a subnet. And what you can do on this single access point is you can actually configure a publicly accessible Wi-Fi. And it was a thing that just, again, this is like 2014, 2015. So people were like bringing their phones to work. And they're like, oh, it'd be nice if I could sit in the staff room and have public Wi-Fi. And that's what I did. And I was like, yeah, this is a cool UI, but it doesn't prove anything. Right, it doesn't help me build a business case. And I think that's where I now start to see the flaws with a POC in that it's only ever going to take your deal so far. What it's not going to do, proving that something works technically, you've shown it works, great.
And by the way, to that point, that shouldn't be a requirement, right? Your thing should just work. Right? Like, this isn't an experimental piece of kit, right? You should... You know, when people are looking at your product, they should assume by default. And by the way, this was a question that I used to get a lot, which is, how do we know that your product works? It's like, what do you mean? I'm sorry. I wouldn't be selling it to you if it didn't work. Yeah, exactly. Like,
that's my, genuinely, and I had a manager a few years ago who his default thing was, he was like, his way of handling POC, and people have been like, well, we need to prove that it works. He's like, look, you want to see this use case? Here's three customers that are doing the same thing as you in the same industry. Go and talk to them. Because, and I think, exactly. And again, I think you can, in a, like a demo, a POC is an artificial environment, and you can, as a field SE, as an organization, you set it up for success, right?
Of course.
I have not ever seen a POC fail. I've seen deals that have gone to POC then go to close, no decision because of budget, and I think it doesn't, it only moves, my thing is like, it only moves the needle so far. And when I look at, I think we're in the same position, it's like, I look at what it can do and I think, okay, yeah, what you're doing is you're removing the need. I can understand the need to remove like a free trial of a piece of software, because the biggest problem I have with free trials, you give someone a free trial with no guidance and they go, oh, it sucks because I don't know how to use it, right? You give someone, if you gave someone a free trial of Photoshop tomorrow, who'd never use Photoshop, they would go, it's a terrible product,
can't
use it, doesn't do anything, right? And I kind of see how like in that space, it fit, but I do think that it's something that we have talked about before on the podcast, and and off the podcast, which is this subset of people who are very, it's like the very online of pre-sales, of the people who are at the kind of the cutting edge, the bleeding edge of this. And I think there are absolutely use cases for this kind of stuff, but I don't think it's going to get rid of companies asking for POCs, and that is their prerogative, right? If that is what they want to do, again, that is their prerogative. And I don't think it's going to address actually delivering them.
AI therapy.
Hi again, Paul.
Hi. Full disclosure, this is not the same day.
Is that the same week? The good news is that I am no longer necking cough syrup. I feel tons better. And thank you so much, Paul, for your patience with me last week and actually letting me recover before we get back to this. So I'm very thankful. Thank you.
You're welcome. The bad news is that I was woken up at 2:30 this morning and haven't really been back to sleep. So it's a role reversal, right? So I'm bringing the manic caffeinated energy.
It's a balance, right? It's always a balancing act between the two of us.
This is very true. I mean, some people might be listening and going, well, what's different?
That is incredibly fair. I have no comeback to that. No notes.
But we got to a point last week and we were like, we need to cut this, but also we still the section that now has a sting. That's what they're called, isn't it? They're called stings, not themes. The little audio, like,
oh,
intro.
Yes.
It has I think it's called a sting, apparently. Oh, yes, it's called apparently. A sting. Audio sting, which I really enjoyed. I didn't actually comment on the fact that I noticed it. I keep thinking, oh, I need to mention this. I really like the sting that you've done.
Yeah, thank you.
It's good. I hope everyone else enjoys it. You know, this is the meta thing. But I have to say, you know, we're talking right about how last week you were, you know, just drinking cough syrup. Every time you stopped talking, Lydia was necking cough syrup, in case you're wondering. And I'm obviously very tired. But the thing is, there's some good news, right? Because we don't need to do this anymore. Because Google have released an update to Notebook LM, which we'll talk about more because I do think it's interesting. But it's essentially like a smart notebook taking tool that now they've added Google Gemini, or the latest version of Google Gemini, which for those of you keeping up is what Google are currently calling their AI large language model. Google and their nomenclature for their various products is a whole podcast episode in and of itself. But essentially, they can now create podcasts from your notes with two hosts that have fun conversations and use sarcasm and puns. And I've also realised that I had planned to actually make one and have it ready for today, but I completely forgot. But maybe for next time, we can take the show notes of this episode.
So far, Gemini would be doing a better job being a podcast host.
It certainly would. Yes. And there are examples out there, and I would encourage people to go and have a look at it. The thing is, let me try and be generous for a minute. The idea behind Notebook LM, and I actually heard this on an interview with Stephen Johnson, who's a tech author who's been quite heavily involved in its creation, was that it's kind of like a personal sort of Wikipedia, or where you can take notes or like so study notes or like some journal articles that you have read or want to read, upload them into Notebook LM, and then search them. And say, I am doing a research project on the history of a hard drive in computing. And you can kind of take like the really dry academic historical text, or even, you know, original sources, and upload them to this and then ask it questions. And I see real potential there as a research tool. And I think Absolutely. It's also that thing that I always struggle with like nonfiction, which is I kind of just want to read the summary and then like pick out the good bits. And that bit now, it now makes podcasts.
Yeah, that's my only problem. The podcast part. What I would have loved, and I know I keep on referring to this, is I want a Jarvis. I want someone, if possible, with a nice British voice to just talk at me about the different things that I have going on, like when it comes to like a specific topic, right? So if it can consume all of my notes on a specific topic, and then I can have a conversation with them about it. Because the thing about podcasts, Paul, and I don't know if you have the same feeling, I like listening to podcasts because of the hosts. It's not so much about yes. getting information. It's nice when the topic is also something I'm quite interested in. But sometimes I can just listen to people talk about things that have nothing to do with my life, with the things that I'm doing or my interests. But if I just enjoy listening to them, I would just listen to them because that's what content is for. So, and to my point, I feel like whomever had this idea slightly missed the point of podcasts. If, and again, I'll be very happy to hear if folks listening are on the same page as me. But to me, it's always been the hosts matter the most, then quality, then content. Whilst this absolutely feels like something that should be a conversation between me and a machine. Yes.
Although I did hear that if you take the specifications for the Cybertruck and input it into Notebook LM, it just transcribes the Joe Rogan podcast for you.
That is brilliant.
Or if you do it for the UK, it's Diary of a CEO. So it kind of knows its audience intersection.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I thought of that joke when I was out for a walk. I was like, I'm quite proud of that. I'm here for like that. That Venn diagram of slander of those three people.
Yeah.
It's chef's kiss.
We're getting feisty, Paul, today.
I did warn you. But it's the thing. It's, as I said, as you say, having a Jarvis, or I think for me, it's sort of, you know, we talked on a very early episode of the podcast about productivity tools, note-taking tools, and we have both tried Obsidian, and I'm still in it, and I'm sort of now in the like I need to make it work for me. And for folks that don't know, Obsidian essentially works on this idea of, rather than having folded pages of notes that you create backlinks and interlinks, and it becomes this like beautiful web of links, so you can jump around in topics. And the thing that I'm kind of finding it most useful for is, as I'm learning a new topic, I'm going, oh, I can take this thing is related to this and it's related to this, so if I then want to search, it will find me all that information. I see that as a real use case. I don't need to have two AIs have a conversation about my notes, though, because, as you say, it's the beauty of podcasts is in the hosts, and I believe podcasting, first and foremost, is an entertainment medium rather than a purely taking in factual information medium. Even if it's a productivity podcast, say. But yeah, I just find it funny that they're like, oh yeah, no podcasting. No, we'll just do that now. We'll just AI podcasting. And I'm sure AI podcasts probably exist. And,
of course they
but
do.
But it's like, it just feels sort of like we've gone a little bit kind of... As I feel like with so much AI stuff, it's like you've taken the thing that we don't really need and we don't really want, and you're doing that. You're not actually just focusing on the thing that would be really, really helpful.
What would be really, really helpful? Like, if we're talking about, like, let's say the use case is, in fact, helping you take in complicated knowledge in a more approachable way. My one was, again, mm-hmm. Jarvis. Mm-hmm. What's yours? Is it a very similar thing? Or
it's a very similar thing, which I think is what Notebook LM is. And again, I have just been busy. It's end of quarter. Trying to get all that done to actually try it. But I think, as you say, the Jarvis example is a good one, because it's, if I think back to when I was like reading tons and tons and tons and tons of academic papers when I was studying, if I could have had a way of taking stuff that I found helpful and going, please, you know, I've gone through my notes and I know that there was this super useful section about this topic. Where was it? And is it mentioned anywhere else? Getting that summary, super helpful. Super, super, super helpful. But I want to be able to, as you say, it's that conversation between you and the machine. You just want to ask it questions and get a response back. You don't want it to be trying to do something extra on top of it.
The other thing that I'm a little bit concerned when it's research. Well, no, actually, even when it's research, I'm having a little bit of a problem there, because obviously, for Google to be able to do this, they are having visibility and access to all of your data that you're putting in, right? It's no secret. It's not a private LLM that you have access to. It is something that they are using to keep on training the model to do that. And I'm sorry to be like a negative Nancy over here. Well, it's like, it does sound like, even, you know, in the context of podcasts, like, I think we've made ourselves very clear, but even in the context of just having something to relay your information back to you, I am very much on the side of the fence where, unless it's in my own home or somebody can prove to me that it's private, aka potentially Apple might be able to do this. We'll see as things keep on progressing with that on that front. Unless it's a private instance that I know it's isolated, and even then, how do I know? How can I be 100% sure? If it's well-known knowledge, that's what ChatGPT is for. right? This is what Gemini is for. Mm-hmm. You ask questions that are already pre-existing out there, and you have conversation based on that. If it's something that I myself am developing, it's my own thoughts and it's my own things that I don't want to have potentially the rest of the world have access to, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I agree. I think what was interesting is this notion that it's going to be something where you can take a text and only query what is in that text. And it will not, even though it might have, as you say, it was going to have a knowledge of the world around it, right? Mm-hmm. Say you took, I don't know, the sort of the earliest specifications for the first ever hard drives that were released and the different iterations of those different types, and you put them in and you said, right, I want, and you started asking it questions about how they worked, what they did. You could turn around to it and go, what did Elon Musk make of the first hard drives? And it would, in a kind of standard large language model, try and come up with, it would sort of try and contextualize what you're asking it, and it would go, I must give you an answer. My understanding is Notebook LM is limited to what you've given it. So it will say, I cannot answer that, or there is no information in the source material that you've given me on that. As far as your own note.
Right, so what you're saying there is that it doesn't connect to something like Gemini.
It uses Gemini as the engine, but it doesn't use
the data,
the context. No, it doesn't try and contextualize. It's purely about querying. You say, here is a book, or here is a, you know, the example in the interview, which he talks about the NASA archive. Here is the NASA archive. Talk to me about the NASA archive.
Yeah.
I don't want to know anything that's not explicitly referenced in this book, you know, in this archive. And when you're giving me information, link me to the sources.
Yeah. Okay. I'm hearing what you're saying there. And fair point about like linking to the actual source, because I think if anyone has had a play with these tools recently, like getting them to actually pinpoint exactly where it's getting its data from, it's an absolute nightmare. Again, my only challenge there is that if it is your own notes, if it's something like that is public knowledge, like as you said, you know, NASA archives, that's fair. That is in the public domain. They already have their grubby hands on it. That's absolutely fine. If you are a PhD student and you're doing your own research and you have thousands of pages of notes that you have taken yourself that you want to go through this, and this might be something that we just need to look up ourselves, and I need to do it after our recording, are they guaranteeing that data is not going to be fed back into the larger model, right? And what are those guarantees?
Agreed. Okay. And we do not disagree on that. I'm not about to start feeding it my own notes, my own thoughts. And I think that's the crucial thing, is it's if you look at it as a limited and specific use.
Yeah. Like all this stuff.
Which is all this stuff. Limited and specific use. A point which, you know, I actually made in the second edition of our new newsletter, the Discovery Digest.
Ooh.
Subscribe now, discoverydigest.substack.com. Is when you're going about trying to learn something, you have to have an idea of where you want to get to. And it's the same with any AI model. You can go and ask Gemini, ChatGPT, even Grok, right? You could ask it a question, but if you don't have an idea of kind of the context you want to get to, or where you're trying to get to, the context you're asking the question in, you're just going to get, it's the garbage in, garbage out standard.
Yeah.
And I think that for me is where I find it super interesting to go, oh, if I could take something that is limited, specific for this research project, and I want to create a GPT that will enable me to go through these thousands of pages of documentation without having to sit and read them with a highlighter, fantastic, right? That would be super useful. But they would be very specific questions about very specific things related to that topic. They would not be broad brushstrokes, tell me about everything that's in here. Summarize the history of NASA for me, because that's where you still end up with hallucination.
I do want to also challenge something, and this comes from my current Danish language learning. I'm very lucky that I have a Danish coach, not a Danish teacher. So his approach is a little bit different from the traditional sort of like, oh, these are the basic words, this is how you start, this is how you say hello, this is how you say good morning, etc. None of this stuff, right? What he keeps on emphasizing that part of the process is for it to be difficult. So for example, whenever I struggle to find a word, or I don't know a word that I want to actually say in English, he encourages me to go and find like a traditional dictionary and use it there If I can't find it there and I can't figure it out from there, okay, go and find, again, a word-by-word translator. Don't use Google Translate. Don't use ChatGPT, which, by the way, if you're learning languages, ChatGPT actually is a really cool tool. Well worth us writing out or talking about at some point. But the point is, it's a specific use case, but for your brain to be able to actually intake this slurry of information that you're trying to feed it, and especially if it's a new thing that you've never done before, if you don't have the habit, if you're not a polyglot that has like 7-8 languages underneath their belts, like learning a language is going to be a new process for your brain to try to go through. So actually carving out those pathways is part of the challenge. And if you try to find a shortcut with a lot of these tools, it's going to be less, like significantly less effective than struggling your way through. Even though it's faster, even though it's going to be more effective. So my point is, that applies to language learning. If you are looking to learn, truly learn and understand a topic, I would also challenge a bit that thinking of like, oh, if I could just summarize these archives, if I just can summarize like whatever it's saying. And I'm not I'm not trying to put words in your mouth there, Paul, about like, you know, this is the way to do it. And I appreciate that there must be use cases. And I know for myself, right? Some things you just need to go to plow through, right? Especially when it comes to legalese and when it comes to like different policies and different like other E's. There are definitely use cases for summarization and understanding things clearer before you dive into them. And that might be the case, right? It might be a, give me a summary, give me some understanding before I actually dive into this content of whatever I'm trying to do. But it's just as just throwing it out there, because it's something I recently learned through this learning language process, is that actually making things a little bit difficult for you in the beginning, the return on investment of that time is tenfold.
And I would come back to that example, and I think we're on the same page here, is that the description of it as a personal Wikipedia is the best way of describing it. Because when I was at university, Wikipedia wasn't new, but it was sort of still viewed quite negatively as this place where there were articles about scorpions on the underground. Kind of thing. Well, did not have a good reputation. Do not cite Wikipedia in your essays, etc. What Wikipedia is good for, though, is giving you a starting point and pointing you to citations and references to do that further reading. And I am a big advocate for, if you're trying to learn about a topic, you need to immerse yourself in that and you need to look at multiple sources. But when you're setting out to understand it, you need some kind of guide. And I think that's where I really see it, is I'm like, right, okay, here is all the information ever about this thing, or here is the really detailed original source material about this thing. And again, original source material isn't a topic for the day, about why it's always not actually that great to use if you're trying to understand something that well. You need to look at second and third sources who have analyzed that source material. But it's giving you and saying, okay, here are the things that are coming up most frequently in this topic. Now go and look into what others have said about them, because I can almost guarantee someone else will have written about them. And I think that's, for me, is that intersection of cutting through the noise and the sort of the chaff of like overload of information that exists in the world today, and also giving you a kind of a map to the things that you actually need to go and read in detail and to really, truly understand them.
Thank you so much for listening to the Wandering Tech Podcast. We really appreciate your time spent with us. And as you can tell, we are continually changing and continually improving. So your feedback is incredibly important to us. So please keep in touch and let us know how we can make this better. You can reach either to me, Lydia Vasileva, or my favorite co-host, Paul Harris, over on LinkedIn. We also are very happy to announce that we have the Discovery Digest newsletter out and about, and we're running and we're posting every week. So please be excited, first of all, and second of all, do subscribe. And again, let us know your feedback. We're doing and trying to give as much as possible back to the community, which is supporting us for so many years. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.